Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Sometimes an entire community can come together over a small plot of land and a handful of seeds. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we'll explore that concept in action from North Louisiana all the way to South Africa. We'll tour Shreveport's Valencia Youth Garden and the Highland Neighborhood Garden with urban farm activists Mary Dumars and Cookie Coleman. Then, Slow Food USA's Richard McCarthy introduces us to Ugandan agronomist Edward Muchibi to discuss the role of community gardens in Africa. Finally, our youngest guest ever, Martine Cruz of Baton Rouge's Episcopal High School, tells about her efforts to properly water the youth of her Gardere neighborhood. We're planting the seeds and can't wait to see what springs up on this week's Louisiana Eats. On a sun-drenched Saturday morning in Shreveport's Stoner Hill neighborhood, the Red River Coalition of Community Gardeners celebrated the grand opening of a new garden at the We Grow Together campus.
Can I serve you some Hoppin' John and jalapeno cornbread?
It makes me want to just cry.
Local residents gathered to share seasonal foods, pick greens, and assist in the planting of new patches. In an area with almost no access to grocery stores offering fresh, healthy food, the new garden presents a move towards a healthier food system for the community. Coordinator Mary Dumars took us on a tour of the space, one that she considers a new focal point of the neighborhood.
My name is Mary Dumars. I'm a master gardener, and I'm also the president of the Red River Coalition of Community Gardeners. We're here at the Martha Street campus of the We Grow Together Learning Center. This is the first of our kind in the city. Behind you, there's a group of coalition members and some visitors sampling different types of food. All the food here is based on purple hull peas, which is what we grew for this first season. So there's big pots of Hoppin' John. There's some purple hull pea bread. We have watermelon cut up on the table. You don't get any southerner than that, right?
This is sweet potato with blackberry drizzle. It's good.
This particular garden has three beds that are just built within the native soil with compost mixed in. And then we have the three raised beds for those who are differently abled. We decided to grow purple hull peas in it, because this is his first year, and that helps fix oxygen into the soil. These peas were actually started to become transplants by one of our own members, and once he got them up to a nice healthy size, we planted them in the first two beds. So those are much more advanced than the rest of these. They're actually ready to be harvested today. And we have a few things we're going to be transplanting. We have some Swiss chard. And over here, we have some herbs.
The garden looks beautiful.
Thank you. We've kept it up, and Cookie's been gracious enough to come every day to make sure it gets watered. When we had that hot spell, It had to be watered every day. So someone would, like, run from work and water, turn it on, and then somebody else might come and turn the water off. You know, so we kind of tag-teamed it. Yeah.
So tell me about how this garden started.
This is a collaboration between the Shreveport City Community Development Department and with the Red River Coalition of Community Gardeners, and several other collaborators are working with us. We determined that we wanted to develop neighborhood food hubs, and it's part of a bigger system called a regional food system. But we're starting with this as a model for the city, where we come in and we build a garden, we encourage the neighborhood to become involved, and we'll have an outdoor pavilion for cooking demonstrations. We'll have a building where we can also do lessons. Currently, our organization does monthly lessons on garden skills, garden tips. So now we'll have a place to do that. We use this as a demonstration garden, but it's also a garden where people can actually harvest, learn to grow food for themselves. There's not really a grocery store close to here, so this is considered a food desert. And having these gardens allows them to be able to be self-sufficient. You know, they learn some skills, life healthy skills. We have health screenings. We have different other components of a healthy lifestyle. But the garden is the center. It's called a community garden, but we're building community around the garden, and that's the focal point.
You know. In this program that you all are implementing, is it too soon to ask, or have you seen some definitive results come out of this work?
Definitely. We've been at this a number of years now. I believe the coalition is in its sixth year this year, and we have done this program in several different places. We have a program in Valencia, Stoner Hill at their community center, Moortown, Allendale, some of the other SPAR centers have introduced a program for after-school kids, and we also come in and teach lessons there. So what we've really seen happen is that people are, they're encouraged, and they're made to feel like they are the resource. They don't have to have money. They don't have to have things. All they need is their know-how and their willingness to work. And they come in, and that garden becomes a place, a safe haven where kids can come, they can enjoy themselves, they can come and take pictures, they can play games, they can do Bible study, whatever that community wants that garden to be. And at the same time, they're growing their own food. That's a win-win. We hope that this would continue to grow in different neighborhoods. And really kind of the utopian vision is that each neighborhood may actually find a distinctive fruit or distinctive vegetable that they're known for, or perhaps some wisdom that they are known for, and be able to barter that with the other gardens, mm-hmm. and therefore create a network all over the city and take that from not just the city, but to reach the farmers. Farmers are interacting with the city folk. And it just grows exponentially until we have that successful regional food system that we're looking at.
Well, I'm so glad we got to come out and visit with you on this morning.
I'm glad you came, too. It's good to see you up in the North Country.
It's really great work you're doing here.
Thank you. We couldn't do it without the community. Just keep eating, and we'll keep growing.
That's it. I can fulfill that request
for you.
Don't
Thank
worry.
You.
Dumars of the Red River Coalition of Community Gardeners. A couple of miles down the Red River is Shreveport's Highland Community Garden. Their mission is to grow healthy food and empower youth and the entire community to share their unique contributions. Coordinator Cookie Coleman explains.
So we have people from all over. Some people walk, people ride bicycles, drive their cars. They're master gardeners, they're home gardeners, they're church members, they're people that's in the community that want to garden with a group because they want to be a part of the garden. And they believe in the nutrition education aspect of learning about your food and appreciating it and eating it right then. But the fun of it, I guess you have to appreciate the seed to just see it grow. You know, that miracle is always fascinating, and that's what gets you hooked. It's seeing how it can grow, and it's so much to learn. I tell people I come here because of the, what I call it, the sunshine, the fellowship, and fun. We love the kids to come. We have lots of little youth groups that come in from churches and community centers. Their favorite thing is to pull up a carrot. You know, they don't really know that carrot thing. But sadly to say, they don't know the carrot comes out of the ground in the dirt. So they like amazed. And I guess one of our biggest goals is to really get people back into appreciating what our farmers are able to do as far as providing food. And we're really having to start from a younger generation because our farmers are getting older. And if we don't convince people that gardening is a viable way of living, then we will have made a difference with our health and everything else. And it's changed my health too, you know, to be able to eat nutritious vegetables and learn about, you know, the way we grow our food. It makes a difference. I tell you what, I've learned so much about nutrition and eating to the point that I told somebody I had an experience with broccoli, that I've eaten broccoli all my life. But until you eat it out the garden, you have never eaten broccoli. Because I was eating like, what is this I'm eating? I'm not eating this before. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, this is broccoli. And I'm said, this is why we do this, because you cannot get that same nutritious values and feelings that you get from it. You know, my kids, my 26-year-old, he's always eating good. He had the peas that we just peeled off, and he was saying, they're good. My 4-year-old grandbaby, she ate an English pea off the vine. People say they don't want something, but they haven't tried it. And so our goal is to say, try this. And what we call it, we got a few people in rehab because they don't like vegetables. So we're rehabbing them and like, come on. And they do okay, you know. But they're worker bees, so we love them. You know, our wonderful compost guy, Mike, he, you know, we're getting him into eating more vegetables. But he's a super compost person, and we don't bug him too hard. I said, take this home to your wife, and she'll cook it for you, you know. So it's about the fellowship that we have here, and they're learning things from them, and we're learning things as we go and making decisions together, what to pull up, what to plant, you know. And it's fulfillment for me. It's very fulfilling for me, and I think I have a purpose, a mission, you know, and a group of people who own that same mission. And so we're trying to change the world and save our farmers. That's one of the things, because if we can get people eating better locally, then we can definitely, you know, farmers will be able to market their crops and make a living. We got to bring farmers back to making a living from our locally grown food. People say, oh, you worry about foreign oil. You better worry about foreign food, okay? Because foreign food can be an issue. Not saying it's not good, but there are jobs there, and there's, you know, nutritional value that we're losing when we're bringing crops in from out. And we need to just focus on our locally grown things that we're dealing with.
Cookie Coleman of Shreveport's Highland Community Garden. The importance of local food isn't just about sustainability. It's also a matter of hometown pride. Chef Hardette Harris noticed that nationally, the conversation about Louisiana eats tends to focus on our southern traditions, while the culinary uniqueness of northern Louisiana was overlooked. Working with local government officials, Chef Hardette created a menu that in 2015 was designated the official meal of North Louisiana. We talked to Chef Hardette about how she created the official meal and to find out what's on the menu.
I grew up in Minden. I just recently moved back. I say recently, it was fall 2013. Minden's like 30 minutes from here, from Shreveport. And when I got back, I said, you know, I don't think I'm the authority on this, but I know what I ate, and I know what we had fresh. So what I wanted to do was celebrate it, because when I moved back here from Texas, it was just Cajun Creole. It kind of had smothered us, and we were still doing it, but I said, no, we need to bring this back to the forefront. So called my representative. How do you, just point me in the right direction, how do you create an official meal? Who does that? So just tell me what to do. I don't know. Oh, well, let me get some information. We'll get back to you. She called me back. She said, well, they want you to type out what you want. I'm still just thinking this is like, you know, the start of it. So I sent it. Didn't hear anything for a few weeks. And then she sent it back, and she said, take a look at this and see if this is what you want. I said, yeah, it looks great. The next thing I knew, fast forward a few weeks, it's voted on. 33 yays, 0 nays. I'm very proud of that.
Wow.
I'm thinking this is going to be like a year in the making, and I'm going to be in the room with the men in black and get, you know, my eyes checked and, you know, my fingerprints. And, you know, you got to do all this to get this passed. So
tell us, what is in an official meal?
Well, Louisiana already had an official meat pie, and that was the Natchitoches meat pie. So I started with the mini meat pies, the appetizer, and then the main dishes have fried fish, barbecue, baked ham, those favorites. And then it goes into the peas and beans, like pinto beans, lima beans, purple whole peas. Then it goes into the greens, mustard greens, turnip greens. And I specifically said cooked with smoked ham hocks and neck bones. I typed that, and they put it on there. I was like, we have an official meal that says ham hocks? But it's so authentic, and that's exactly, and that's what it is. So then it goes into the side dishes, sweet potatoes, potato salads, and desserts, and condiments like mayo jelly and hot sauce, and all those things that we eat up here. And sweet tea, of course.
Of course, of course.
Of course, and pecan pies, and pound cake, and peach cobbler, all those wonderful things. So it's really, my idea was to not put down favorites, but to put down the things that we can go pick out of the garden and pick from the trees and pull from our fresh waters. The reason I know that it got passed and was not any opposition to it and everybody's supporting it is because we needed it. We have all this wonderful flavor here. And when you look at the meal, all of the feedback I've heard was, yep, you hit it on the head. This is it. This is what, if I grew up in that area, spent summers in North Louisiana, this is exactly what we ate. This is not to poo-poo on South Louisiana, Cajun Creole. We do that very well here in North Louisiana, too. I want to celebrate that, too. But I want us to start, you know, eating our food and not shoving it to the back. It's kind of like that favorite toy you have when the kids come over and, well, let me put that toy up and play with the one I know everybody likes. It's our food. Let's just keep it out. Let's serve it. Because growing up here and eating here with all my family and people in Minden, Louisiana, for some reason I knew that that food I was eating then was extremely good. I don't know how I knew that. I knew that this tasted so good with these fresh onions and tomatoes as side condiments and these fresh field peas that we helped to shell, you know. And we're still eating it. We're still growing it. And I want everybody else to eat it. When we have conventions, VIPs, all these wonderful celebrities and concerts and films that we shoot here, I want those people to eat that. You know, if you go on a trip to the mountains in France or somewhere and you're going on a trip and you stop for lunch in a little village, you're expecting them to serve you what they eat in that village. And that's what I want. I want us to serve what we grow here, not 6 hours away.
When we come back from a short break, we sit down with another crusader in the campaign for community engagement in local agriculture. But his hometown is over 8,000 miles away from Louisiana. Stay tuned. It's got to be love. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Community garden can be so much more than a place to grow produce, and the 10,000 Gardens Project in Africa is living proof of that fact. As a young agronomist in Uganda, Edward Muchibi has sought to transform the food system by reestablishing community ties to the land. Now, as vice president of Slow Food International, Edward is making those ideals a reality. his continent-wide initiative cultivates community gardens while promoting agricultural sustainability. To bridge the gap between his project and American cities, Edward traveled across the U.S. with Executive Director of Slow Food USA, Richard McCarthy. They visited our studio while stopping in New Orleans. Edward arrived bearing good news from Africa.
Many times on the news, we hear about the atrocities in Africa. We hear about the hunger, the Ebola. We hear about all the problems, the war in Africa. And this is what many times comes to the media. But there is a lot of interesting, good things done by young people in Africa who want to see a change in the face of the continent, who want to see the bright side of Africa being shared with other people, especially when it comes to food, environment, and agriculture. We are teaming up with the Global Food Movement, with Slow Food International, to showcase the traditional agriculture, which is capable and in good position to feed Africa for now and for the future. So these are take an initiative of the 10,000 Gardens in Africa project, supported by Slow Food International, started by us in Africa. It's not a project which was started in Italy. It was started from Uganda, Kenya. We went all the way to Tanzania, Morocco, Senegal, Mali, now in Nigeria, Somalia. Even in very difficult places, people deserve the right to good, clean, and fair food. And we need to defend our traditional food more than any other continent on earth. We need to defend our biodiversity as Africans more than anyone. And this is the work which we do every day. And we need to build our communities around food, around our gastronomy, around environment, and build and be so innovative in our traditional farming systems.
So, who thought up 10,000 Gardens? And explain to us exactly how the 10,000 Gardens project works.
The 10,000 Gardens in Africa idea was thought from the rural schools, like the schools where I went. It's a long history of my childhood, which I share with many young people in Africa. I grew up in a farming family, and I went to school where something which I was proud of was a punishment. Farming was used as a punishment. If you do any wrong thing at school, like coming late, they send you to put down a bush, put up a few crops for the teachers or for the school to sell and get revenue. And this scared many young people from farming. And this is something which didn't only happen in my school, but many schools in Uganda, many schools in East Africa, and maybe schools in other parts of Africa. And I always had the desire to change this because I was proud of my mom, proud of my family being farmers. And I went to the university and I chose to study agronomy, agriculture, land use, management. So in 2006, I created a new school in my community. I created the first school garden in my life. I worked with kids of 3 to 6 years, and many schools around, even those where I went and which were still using farming as a punishment, picked up the idea of letting kids decide what they want to do in the garden, not to force them. And the same work was going on in many parts of Africa, which we started connecting through the Slow Food Network. When I joined Slow Food in 2008, I was invited to attend Terra Madre in Italy, this big Slow Food event, to share my ideas, to connect with a network of over 1 million activists worldwide who are promoting the same thing. And I realized I was not alone. We started talking to other people from other countries, and the number of gardens started growing with the support of Slow Food. And when we talk about the 10,000 gardens in Africa, when someone talks about a garden, this is, to many people, it's a place where you put seeds and harvest vegetables, you harvest stuff. But to us in Africa, they are learning spaces for families. There are places where families meet, discuss the future of food in the communities, discuss the future of our seeds. These are places where we have cross-generation knowledge transfer. And also, there are pillars on which we are building communities. They are pillars where we are building the revolution to change the food system in Africa to a better system. And also, most importantly, these are symbols of resistance to the bad food system. They are symbols of resistance to monoculture, which is cropping up in Africa, promoted by rich, rich, big multinational corporations. And also, these are pillars of symbols of resistance to land grabbing, which is the order of the day in Africa. Many rich corporations going through our local politicians are grabbing millions of hectares of farmland from poor African families, claiming that the land is not utilized in the right way. But the right way to use this land is to cultivate communities, to cultivate gardens. Many times we have been lacking young and energetic leaders in Africa to take our continent forward in terms of food. But these are now the people we are cultivating in the gardens. Now we have many, many leaders. Every single garden has a leader.
Well, you are so very fortunate in having such a good ally with Slow Food. And Richard, would you talk to us about how Slow Food figures into the 10,000 Garden Project and particularly focus on what it means to us here in the United States?
Well, I think when you listen to Eddie's description of the culture of the 10,000 Gardens in Africa, what I hear is that precarious, gorgeous balance between pleasure and social responsibility. And the balance between joy for food, for traditional foods, and also the justice around food. We felt that this story coming from Africa is so positive and so infectious that we wanted to share this good news coming from Africa with many of the young emerging food leaders in the most unexpected places in the United States. So when I think of so much of what I hear Eddie describe about the Gardens Project in Africa, I'm reminded of New Orleans and what role food and gardens have played to capture people's imagination, to rethink where we live, to honor tradition, and also to think very innovatively about where our food comes from, the new places that we can connect food and culture and economic opportunity, and move beyond that discussion that all solutions must go to scale. Move beyond the idea of just food security, access to fresh, healthy food, but go deeper to food sovereignty. When I think of how in New Orleans much of the 20th century treated us, was that our food traditions are in the way of progress, that we must abandon them. And this deficit thinking, this kind of colonial thinking, we need to decolonize our minds and actually reconnect with those cultural assets that are our grandparents' recipes, and harness those with so many of the new ideas that are springing up all over the United States. So many of these issues that are at the core of how we grow wealth and community in Africa are so much like the issues we face in the United States. But we're so divided by our narratives that we've got it figured out and the global South hasn't, and we have to help them. No, what we just need to be able to provide is the space for them to grow their own future rather than intervening in their models. So the message, whether it's here or working with the Indian Springs Farmers Association in Mississippi, where they're fighting heroically to save multi-generational black land, or here in New Orleans, or here in Oakland, is the idea that food is this extraordinary community connector and that we must harness this and share ideas globally.
What is food sovereignty?
Well, food sovereignty has really begun to capture the question that many local communities feel when they are being saved by outsiders, and that outsiders are coming in with either supermarkets or policies to ensure greater food security. And food security is a belief system that we share, the access to safe, secure sources of food. But it matters where that food comes from. Because when you consider the precarious ecology of local economies, if that food that comes in to bring food security is dumped in a local market, then you undermine the ability of that local community to feed itself, mm-hmm. to grow its own wealth, to preserve its own traditions, to utilize its own traditional knowledge. And therefore, this idea of food sovereignty that we, in vulnerable communities, and especially in the U.S., communities of color, that are isolated from the mainstream food economy. And when the food economy comes, it comes to actually extract the wealth, not to grow it in the community. So the idea of growing local gardens, local stores, co-ops, farmers markets, CSAs, all these amazing new innovative institutions that are in some ways inventing old ones and reinventing them in a modern context, help to bring food sovereignty. So the idea that food and democracy at their core must be tied together.
What are some of the things that you've observed on this particular trip that have surprised you?
The most interesting thing I found in Detroit, in the cities, how communities are preserved and built stronger around food, how you can use the gardens to rebuild the city, to use the empty spaces and also to attract more and more people. I've seen young people getting involved in the gardens in Detroit. I've seen the energy which is down there. And also I was surprised to see that the souls and energy of the people in Detroit is very, very much connected to Africa for me, which is a very important thing.
And Richard, what ultimately do you all hope to come out of this visit?
That's a great question. We hope to educate Americans about Africa, to not believe the hype that Africans cannot run their continent. They're perfectly capable of running it. The challenge is the political structures, the policies that we have in the U.S. There's some very good foreign aid programs. There's some very bad ones. We hope to inform American voters about these issues, to be good citizens. We hope to create more international connections. In Detroit, the interest from the Detroit public school system was to create learning exchanges between African gardens and Detroit gardens. I would love to see that in New Orleans, because certainly the impact, the African footprint on our food and culture and place is so essential. And to be able to keep that going would be the kinds of things that I think that at its core, that's what slow food is for, to bring people together and sometimes the most unexpected people together around food.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming, and what an honor and a pleasure to meet you, Eddie. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being part of the Great Revolution. This is what we need, to share our stories, our positive side of the coin. Thank you so much for the time.
International Slow Food Vice President Edward Muchibi and Slow Food USA's Executive Director Richard McCarthy. Revolution rock, it is a brand new rock. A bye-bye rock, this here revolution rock. For over 25 years, the nonprofit organization Old Ways has strived to honor cultural food traditions while promoting good health. Their African Heritage and Health program presents community classes that blend together nutrition, history, and simple cooking techniques, inspiring people to think differently about old ways. The program was offered at New Orleans East Village Desjardins Senior Community Apartments. Dozens of residents eagerly attended every week, and after class, everybody joined together in a healthy meal. Producer Joe Schreiner sent us this postcard.
So, did anybody complete their homework? Did anybody try a new whole grain that they've never tried before? You can just raise your hand.
I am Alicia Boutte, and I'm one of the Old Ways instructors here in New Orleans.
And I'm Phyllis Boudreaux, and I'm one of the Old Ways presenters also.
Today we are at Village Desjardins here in New Orleans East.
Well, this week we're going to totally switch it up.
Okay.
You're talking about tubers and mashes. Who knows what a tuber is?
Sweet potatoes.
Sweet potatoes. Is that the only kind of tuber?
Old Ways was started in 1990. to kind of combat all the chronic diseases that are on the rise, like diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure. So we are starting this movement of teaching people how to eat plant-based, healthy foods that are based on the African heritage in an effort to kind of inspire this lifestyle change.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Alicia. How are you? I'm gonna start off with a question. How many of us are kind of hesitant to try something new because we aren't sure how to prepare it? You know, we've seen the taro, we've seen all these different tubers that we may have never had. Well, we're providing you with a chart of some preparation tips.
Oh, okay. We started the program actually 5 weeks ago. It's a 6-week program. We've had participants who are not just named participants, they actually participate in everything we do here. They appreciate us being here and the fact that they can live healthier. Okay, dishes we're gonna have today. Senegalese sweet potato peanut stew. Woo! Come on, y'all know y'all want to
My name is Tony Hatcher. I stay in Building 16. To me, it's like spinach and potatoes. It would look like spinach and squash and stuff like that. That's what it looked like to me. But it's healthy. What it is, it's a light food. It's not like something heavy on your stomach. It's about teaching us how to eat healthy. Everybody's supposed to eat healthy. But like when you get at that certain age level, you got to really take care of yourself because, you know, when you get around into your 50s and 60s, you're dealing with high blood pressure, diabetic, you know, and stuff like that. And then you got to watch how to eat.
What do we think? Good? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
The greens and corn is pretty good.
It tastes good, man.
It's kind of spicy.
Spicy.
It's kind of spicy. Yeah. I can't eat nothing spicy.
Young lady.
Yeah.
This tastes good.
Good. Why'd you like
you cooked that?
Nope.
Okay.
That was Miss Phyllis
back. Okay.
Go ahead.
I enjoy it because it's something dealing with your health. You know, it's in the teachers and the ladies who come here, and I appreciate them to the highest, you know, for their effort. And I thank them so much. Always got to eat healthy, you know. When you eat healthy, you feel healthy. Your mind is strong, you know, and that's what it's all about.
Safe is your drinking water? Stay tuned, and we'll explore that topic when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. This week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How safe is your drinking water? A recent report by the National Resources Defense Study of Drinking Water in 19 cities, including New Orleans, turned up some pretty disturbing news. Pollution and deteriorating out-of-date plumbing are sometimes delivering drinking water that could pose significant health risks. Rocket fuel, harmful to the thyroid and possibly carcinogenic, was found in the tap water of 20 million Americans. Particularly high levels have been measured in Los Angeles, Phoenix, and San Diego. Residents of Flint, Michigan are currently at the epicenter of the lead crisis. Lead can cause brain damage and decreased intelligence in children. Often, the culprit isn't the water system. It's corroding pipes and faucets, which can be a real problem in old Louisiana homes. Germs, including coliform bacteria and cryptosporidium, often show up. Arsenic is present in significant levels in many water systems. But humans need to consume at least a half gallon of water each day. So what's the answer to drinking water that's safe? Inexpensive carbon filters work effectively, and those pricey reverse osmosis systems do a great job for whole house water purification. But the best method is the fairly simple process of distillation. During the distillation process, water's heated until it boils and turns to steam. The boiling action kills the various bacteria and other pathogens. As the steam rises, it leaves behind waste material, minerals, heavy metals, and other heavier contaminants. The steam is then cooled and returns to water. So drink your water. It's important. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
I'm Martine Cruz. I'm from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and I go to Episcopal High School, and I'm a junior there.
Martine Cruz is the youngest person we've ever interviewed on Louisiana Eats. But when I learned of the ambitious project that she is so very passionate about, I knew we just had to share her story with our Louisiana Eats listening audience.
So I first began realizing that there was a problem with kids drinking water at school. I noticed that my classmates, although they carried around their water bottles, that they weren't drinking water. And even with my friends who are athletes, you know, they're not drinking water when they walk into class. They're drinking coffee. They're drinking energy drinks. They're drinking soda. And I'm sitting here thinking do you realize how bad that is for you? That's going to affect you later at your game or later at your meet or during your race. And although they are aware of this, they're not willing to make a change because there's not access to this. Even though I do go to a school that is, you know, very well funded, it's a wonderful institution, the water fountains are broken.
Okay.
And the problem is since it's a very spread out campus, kids in my grade with their reusable trendy water bottles, they're not going to walk 200 yards to go get water. Like, they just aren't. So I thought to myself, is there a real problem, even though kids might be informed that they're not making the right decisions? So I decided to interview younger kids, specifically kids who are 10 and 8, over the summer, one summer at the Y over here in the West Bank. And I work with the Fox Leadership Institute, which is associated with the University of Pennsylvania, with one of their fellows who was working at the Y. And I started interviewing these kids, and they know what's healthy and they know what's not. But even though they have an idea of what's healthy, it might not be the best idea. So they still think that fruit juice is really great, even though a lot of it has added sugar. They still think sports drinks are great, even though they really don't need to be drinking them. And you know, water's great, but they're not drinking water. They're not bringing water in their lunch boxes. And I realized, this is a problem that begins in childhood. But the thing is most kids aren't going to listen to you. They're going to listen to their parents, and they're going to eat and drink what their parents are putting in front of them. So it's teenagers will listen to you, and they make their own choices already, so maybe I should be focusing more on a demographic of teens. So I started, being more aware of what my classmates were drinking at school, and I realized, they don't care. They're kind of clueless about this. And I thought, my classmates might be educated about this, but there might be other kids my age who aren't necessarily as knowledgeable about what they're drinking and what's in it. So I was like, okay, what's a group of students that I can interview or that I can, observe? And my dad does a lot of work in the Gardier neighborhood, and I said, hey, why not?
Tell me about the Gardier neighborhood.
Well, the Gardier neighborhood is adjacent to where I live, but I specifically decided to survey kids in this neighborhood because it's more diverse than where I live, and also because the kids come from, all different walks of life, and I thought that would be a great way to get an interesting population to our survey.
So there's two zip codes. There's even two state representative districts. actually in the Gardere neighborhood, there's really two different Gardeers, isn't there?
Well, yeah. Gardere falls in the 70810 zip code, which, believe it or not, is the wealthiest zip code in Louisiana, I think. This is where, like, the Baton Rouge Country Club lies, I believe. The street Burbank, which runs in between the Gardere neighborhood and Highland Road, basically is, like, a barrier between this neighborhood and, I guess, the more affluent side, which is on Highland Road. There is a program there. It's a sports program for the kids, and it's a separate program, but they work with the initiative who do the athletic programs there.
What is the Gardere Initiative?
It's a nonprofit organization that does outreach work for the kids in the neighborhood and provides them with resources that, like, they otherwise would not have. So just recently, I went over to the Gardere neighborhood, and I kind of pitched them what I wanted to do, and they were very supportive. And I think that it's interesting to, you know, get a different perspective from a different group of kids. But I realized that in order to prove to people that this is a problem, it's best that I have quantitative data to show them. Because I can tell someone, hey, this is an issue. Maybe you should try to do something about it. Maybe you should donate something. People aren't going to buy into that unless they see some proof. And that's where the survey comes in. But it also comes into play when I want to say, hey, I want to do something educational. People are like, so why? These kids already know. But it's not that they don't already know. It's that there needs to be a push to push these kids to realize, like, hey, like, you're really not making the best decision, and this is detrimental to your health in the long run. I decided to, like, choose water out of, like, all the other food, you know, issues that are going on right now because it's so accessible. When it comes down to it, even the water bottle that we drink comes from the tap water. Like, you might be convinced that your artisan water is, you know, different, but it really isn't. They probably got it in the tap water from some springs, you know, in Maine or something. It's not special. And because it's so accessible, it's easier to convince people to drink it because there isn't something that's preventing them from drinking it. They can just turn on their faucet and get water.
With all of your water research and thinking about water, have you given any thought to the fact that water is really in the future going to be one of our biggest issues?
Yeah, I thought about that a lot. I mean, a lot of times people don't realize that one of our most precious resources is fresh water. You have to take into account that, like, millions and millions of people don't have access to clean water, and that we do, and then we're just destroying the ability to have clean access to water in the future. And that doesn't make sense to me. Like, this is the most basic part of living. And I really wish that some people would realize, you know, even though it might have short-term benefits, think about the long-term negative effects of, you know, destroying clean water, especially clean fresh water.
Well, you're very inspirational. And I have to say, I'm just thrilled that we had this opportunity to hear from you about a topic that obviously you are just on fire about. So don't let all that water put the fire out. Once you get the results of all this, please come back and share it with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Baton Rouge Episcopal High School junior, Martine Cruz. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we celebrate our one-year anniversary at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum with a walking tour of our neighborhood to meet the neighbors.
Here at Cafe Reconcile, our mission is to help young people to change their lives for the better. You know, we're here not only for the community, but for the city, and for anybody that we can help.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Whirline building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.